On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
I am thrilled to have Harvey Lisberg today with us on the Bookshelf. That's not a name with which most of you are familiar, but you know the work that he's done because he's managed two of the great groups, some of our core artists that people listen to on our radio station all the time. That is Herman's Hermits and 10cc, as well as lots of other people and had some amazing adventures. Harvey Lisberg's new book is I'm Into Something Good, My Life Managing 10cc, Herman's Hermits, and Many More, with Charlie Thomas helping, and it's from Omnibus Press. You can check omnibuspress.com to find out more. It's loaded with wonderful stories. Harvey Lisberg, thanks so much for making time to talk to us today on the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Very nice talking to you, wherever you are, in Canada somewhere.
We're in Troy, Alabama, so...
Oh, my, you went down south. My God, I'm sorry I got that wrong.
that is perfectly fine. Well, so you are from Manchester, England, and Manchester has kind of an interesting relationship with the other major cities of northern England. There's kind of a rivalry going on with Liverpool, and you were involved in a lot of interesting stuff, and then you heard the Beatles, and that really was a huge change for you, right?
Yeah, it revolutionized everything for everybody that was interested in music. And the Beatles just opened the door for English acts and led the British invasion. I was writing songs at the time. They weren't very good songs. I was trying to place them with people, and I didn't have much success with this. So I decided I'll do my own. I'll get my own group, and with that group, I'll let them do my songs. So that's how I organized a church competition in the hall. And they came through with Herman and the Hermits, and I went to see them, and they were fantastic. They were being charged on the stage by these little girls, and I thought I'd won the lottery because it was so great. I was so happy. I found a massive band which could compete with the Beatles, maybe. I found out later they had planted in the audience all people, all their friends and everything to scream. So I was completely bemused by it. They baked a cake for me. So I went back to Peter's house after the gig. And, of course, Peter was very, very, very nice. We got on very well. I was pottering around on his piano in his house playing Tell Me What I Say by Ray Charles. And then I asked him, I'd like to manage a band. And he said, well, would you like to be in the band? I said, no, I just want to be in the band. And I'd like to... I'm sorry, there's lots of noise going on in the background here.
Oh, that's okay.
I said, I'd like to manage the band, and I'd like you to do my songs. And that's how it began. Simple as that.
Now, Peter Noon, Herman, he was only 15 at the time you saw him heading this band, Herman and the Hermits, that later became Herman's Hermits. But you could tell that he had enormous crowd appeal, even though they did salt the audience a little bit. Nonetheless, everywhere they went from that forward, people loved him and they loved the band, right?
Yeah, he had a clean-cut image. It was really nice. The boy next door, you know, if a mother saw a Beatle come down the drive, she'd think, oh, this is a bit strange. And if a Rolling Stone came down the drive, she'd get a bottle of cyanide or something. But if Peter came down the drive, nice, clean-cut, Kennedy-like, Catholic, blue-eyed boy, they would be quite comfortable with that. So he was the boy next door that all the girls just charged to see. Loved him. Yep. Now, and he was very young.
One of the things that I learned from your book is that the songs that were popular in England were not necessarily the same songs that were popular in the United States. And that was the case with Herman's Hermits, but also with the group that you handled in the 70s, 10cc. Is that just because... that American tastes are slightly different, or is it?
Well, in the first case, Mickey Most controlled all the music that Herman's Hermits put out, and sometimes he rejected some very good songs which I controlled, like For Your Love and Bus Stop, which were submitted to Herman's Hermits, and Mickey Most rejected them. He decided what went out, and of course we started off with cover version. I'm Into Something Good with a cover version of a Coffin King number done by Earl Jean. And then the follow-up was Show Me Girls, another Coffin King number, and the next number was a cover by the Ray Silhouettes. And so he selected all those songs. Mickey Mouse was a genius at picking music. But he also selected what went out in America, much to my annoyance at the time. For instance, No Milk Today, which was a huge hit in Europe, wasn't even put out as an A-side in America. It was the B-side of Those Kind of Us. So we had really no control. With 10cc, that was a totally different ball game. They were an act that every track was different, and it didn't really fit the American format, because American format is radio at that time, played much more or less the same thing, and they weren't ready for 10cc, and also 10cc had an awful record label that weren't helping. And finally, they'd rejected a tour to support the Eagles, which would have burst them wide open. So on top of everything else, I think it was a land of missed opportunities for 10cc, although the music was magnificent and the hits were flowing all over the world, as you say. I mean, right. We had about 10 hits, which just never saw the light of day in America. Were never released as singles.
With Herman's Hermits, Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and I'm Henry the Eighth, I Am, those are the first songs I can remember hearing when I was a young teen. In the early 60s, I can remember hearing those songs on the radio and just enjoying them a great deal. But those weren't particularly hits in England.
Never released in England, Mrs. Brown. It was part of Peter's act. When I saw Peter the first time, he was playing that on stage. It was just an oddment at the end of the act. It was, and when Mickey was doing an album, he needed an extra track to finish the album up, and asked the boys, "Have you got anything?" And they said, "Well, we've got this thing," and they played it. He recorded it. One take, voices and sound together, all together, and that was it. And Mickey was... then the DJs in America, for some reason, picked on this track on the album. And Mickey said, "No, I don't want that to go out as a single. No way," because it wasn't anything much to do with him. He just recorded it live, like our conversation now.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the answer was... MGM said, "Well, we'll pay you on $600,000 if you allow us to release it as a single," and Mickey refused again. Anyhow, finally they offered to pay on $1 million, and he agreed. And it was the highest entry in Billboard of that time of any single. It came in at 12, went to 3, went to 1, stayed at 1 for 4 weeks, outsold the Beatles, who had Help, at number 2. So you can imagine what an impact that was on the British invasion and how it lifted us the sky. And as Peter was so young, I had to always go to the court, Bow Street Magistrates Court, to get permission to act in loco parentis instead of being a parent. You can't get, because immigration and everything went on with work visas, you had to have somebody that was responsible. And I was the person that was. And meanwhile, John Lennon's switching drinks in the clubs in London with him and switching Cokes for rum and Coke. So between us, we did a good job, I reckon.
Yes, I think so. I was going to tell you that just before COVID happened, that I had the privilege of talking to Peter Noon. He was going on an oldies tour in the United States with a lot of his old mates from the British invasion, and they were traveling around and singing each other's songs as the backup singers. And then the lead singers that were traveling, you know, they would sing lead on them. And I just thought that sounded like the most fun thing to do. And then everything changed. And I'm wondering if he is still doing those kind of things. I hear him on the radio on Sirius XM on the 60s channel.
Yes, he's doing a lot of touring. He's done more work this year than, well, he's earning more money. I don't know if he's done more work, but he's doing lots of work, really. Almost every weekend, 5 days a week, he's working now, fairs, all sorts of places, all over the country.
How about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not specifically involved in that at the moment, although I keep a very close relationship with him, and I'm very impressed with the work he is doing. And I think he came to a book launch of mine in Santa Monica, Los Angeles, a month ago.
Lovely.
And he performed with his guitarist, Vince. Vince, I mean, not Vince, but he's a wonderful guitarist, and
yeah.
The two of them did about 6 numbers, which is on my Facebook page, which is quite good, really. You know, he did Mrs. Brown, Henry VIII,
uh-huh.
Kind of Us, No Milk Today, Listen People, I'm in Something Good, so it was quite a nice treat for the people at the party.
Yes. What a lovely thing to do. I'm delighted to hear that you guys still have such a good relationship. You can tell in your book that the people that you manage, people like that, they were special to you. These were not just clients, people to make money from. These were people that you knew and liked to work with, and you watched out for them. And
it was all to do with the era. It was just exciting times.
Yeah.
Everybody in the music industry was like, it was a bit of a battle, but it was a friendly battle, and everybody, the British invasion was just something else. I mean, it was incredible how we took over the American airwaves.
We had
1, 2, and 3 in Billboard.
Oh, I remember.
And when 1965.
When the Monkees came out, it was sort of seen as, at least in the States, as, well, America's trying to hold their own again against the British invasion. So we'll get a guy from England to be one of the singers. That'll show them. Davy Jones.
Actually, Davy Jones was from Manchester as well. Yeah, but the thing about that was that the Beatles were the gods. I mean, you know, everything else was good, and there's some great stuff. Not knocking the Rolling Stones or anything; they were great. But really speaking, without the Beatles and their music, their humor, their voices, they were the sort of Mozarts of our time.
Yeah, yeah. That's the truth. I remember I was a music ed major and taking music ed classes in the early 70s. One of my music history professors said that 100 years from now, no one's going to remember most of the stuff that's been released, but they will still be playing songs by the Beatles because theirs was revolutionary. And that really impressed me. This is a guy that was a huge classical music fan. And I didn't know he even knew who the Beatles were, but he did. And of course, here we are 50 years later, and it's still the case. What a fascinating, exciting time to be in the business.
It's lucky just to have been living through those times. And it wasn't just the music. It was also art, mm-hmm. Everything in England, fashion, Carnaby Street, everything, people getting jobs when they were young, the young revolution as well as the music revolution. So it was just, something very special. And actually, you say you're in Alabama. I must tell you the story about Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
I think we did Montgomery, Alabama, Herman's Hermits and The Who. And I get a call at 2:30 in the morning when I'm playing cards after the gig with the Herman's Hermits. And this voice, I'm not very good with the Birmingham accent, I missed a little burr with a drawl. I said, yes. He says, I've got something to report to you. He says, Mr. Moon's room has no toilet in it. I said, what do you mean there's no toilet? He said, well, put it this way, the toilet has been taken out of the wall. And, of course, Keith had been dropping cherry bombs down the toilet to so many that it blew the thing out of the wall and there was a total mess. I think they were banned from the Holiday Inn for God knows how long. And I, as the parent group, the headliner, had to take the can with it with this guy at 2:30 in the morning. So that's my story. We did Montgomery, Alabama, then Birmingham, Alabama the next day. And then I think we did Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We're doing all the South. We started in the South, actually. Our first dates were Lubbock, Texas, all the way down South through the Southern states, funnily enough. So, and that was in 1965.
Something else that you wrote about in the book that really surprised me, one of the things that you and guys like you helped change is that back in the kind of this early era for albums, that artists didn't make very much money per album. We usually think of somebody releases an album that the people who make the music make all the money. But that's not the case at all. It wasn't then. And here you say, in those days, a new band could expect to get about 10% for an album. For a 5-year contract with the UK, this is
true. But the Beatles had a 1% deal originally, and half for overseas. So 10% was quite reasonable.
Wow!
10% was because originally, I mean, our original deal with Jonathan King was for 4%. So at the end of the day, there were 4 members of the band and the management, and Jonathan King made more from his percentage than all of us put together, and that's really led to the demise of us moving to another label.
Yeah.
It's an English law. You can't force somebody to work. All you can do is get damages.
The group 10cc, they were really close to your heart as well. This is an incredibly interesting band. And unfortunately, in the United States, working at a radio station, we didn't ever play album cuts particularly. We played singles. So I knew mm-hmm. their hit singles, but I really didn't know a lot of the other songs that you talk about in here. So I've been looking up these other songs on YouTube and listening to them, and oh my goodness, these guys were brilliant. You're right. They're incredibly inventive and clever and funny.
I thought they were going to be as big as the Beatles, quite frankly. I thought they had the talent to be. Unfortunately, as I say, they didn't take the opportunities they had. You know, American bands like Supertramp, they do the first three tracks on the album would be brilliant, all number ones, and the rest would be a load of garbage, but you didn't find that with 10cc. 10cc, every track stood up for whatever it stood up for. And Kevin Lowell with geniuses at humour. Graham was a genius as a guitarist and a songwriter, as we know. And Eric was a brilliant producer. They had everything going for them, even more so than the Beatles, because the Beatles had George Martin as their own. But 10cc was totally self-contained. And they had their own studio, which they built. I mean, everything was in Manchester as well, which was very important to us. So that was it, in a nutshell.
And then the taste changed. Punk rock came along, and all of that cleverness was no longer valued. All that mattered was, you know, can we be angry? I was not happy disc jockey, I can tell you, when punk rock came along, because I like the intelligent stuff, and I like bright and fun stuff, not into angst so much.
Well, it became political. It was a political motive. You know, the punk era was just rebelling against all the overproduction. People running around in Ferraris, planes, you know. I mean, it was political.
Yep.
You know, yeah. And I packed it in then. I realized I can't get any other tracks played. Nobody would play anything. So I thought, well, okay, well, I'll go out of it. And I went into sports. I started doing playing in a sport called snooker. I don't think it's that big in America, but a bit like pool. I got involved in that for about 4 years. And then I went back into music afterwards again. I don't like political music. I don't like the mixing politics and music. I mean,
I'm with
music
you.
To me,
yeah.
is a sound. I mean, Mozart, to me, wasn't political.
Right.
You know, it's just brilliant music. What can you say?
Yeah. The funniest story that you tell in here on yourself was that you had the opportunity to sign a pair of young songwriters and just couldn't ever really figure out what you could do with them, and therefore you didn't take their money. You just said, well, I'm sorry, thank you, you guys are great, but I just don't think we're the right combination. I'm not sure what you're going to do. And they turned out to be relatively successful.
Yes. Well, it wasn't. They came to me because they had a track with Herman Thurman. It was called I Fancy You, which subsequently was from Joseph and the Dreamcoat, which
right.
subsequently became a number one, and Mickey Most rejected it, as he rejected everything else. And for some reason... And I put them on a development deal for 2 years. Tried to sell Joseph to about 17 different companies. And I was rejected by everybody, and all the people around me were saying, what are you messing around with this? But I knew there was something there. And then they said, well, we've done this thing, which came to the end of the contract. I was paying them like $10 a week each for 2 years. And then it came to renewal time. And they just finished Jesus Christ Superstar. Well, you know, being a Jewish boy who's quite famous in my local area, I was not really ready to promote Jesus Christ. It wouldn't have gone down
right.
well with the neighbors.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
influenced me. And it was probably the biggest mistake I ever made. But I still have a very good relationship with Tim Rice and Andrew Ludlow. They're very nice people. And I love their music as well as the Beatles.
Yeah.
Andrew Lloyd Webber's tremendous music. Anyway, that's my story there.
The book is just one wonderful story after another, and appreciate so much the opportunity to read it. The fact that you signed a copy for me, that is very cool. That hardly ever happens. I've been reviewing books on the radio for over 30 years, and I can, on one hand, how many of them the author took the time to actually write his name in the book for me. So believe me, this is not going to end up on eBay or anything. This one, my sons will have to fight over. When the day comes that I'm no longer reading.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the book so much. That's great. And thanks for having me on your broadcast. We'll do it again sometime if you want later in the year. We'll cover some other subjects or anytime you like.
All right. That would be marvelous. Great honor
okay.
to get to talk to you.
Okay. Nice talking to you, and thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Cheers. Bye.
Once again today, we've been talking to Harvey Lisberg, who is the author of I'm Into Something Good, My Life Managing 10cc, Herman's Hermits, and many more. It's available from Omnibus Press. You can check omnibuspress.com. Harvey had the opportunity to be a part of the British invasion and subsequent music in not only in the 1960s, but in the 1970s, and he tells these wonderful stories with great humor and with great joy. So our thanks to him to joining us today on the Bookshelf.